Hello, everybody. This is Ron Brinkman with the VFX show, and coming to you today with John Labrie.
Hello.
Hey, John. John's joining me also from the Los Angeles area. And then Mike Seymour is joining us from Down Under today. Mike, you there?
G'day guys, how are you? Yeah, man.
Mike is the
Nice to be on the show.
hello? You there, Mike?
Yeah, nice to be on the show.
There we go. Very good. And Mike, of course, from FX Guide, who I think we've mentioned a couple of times already, is doing some great in-depth coverage of visual effects related things. And I just poking around the website, and they've got a little bit more stuff than what they had the last time when we talked about the X-Men stuff, including a much more detailed look at the some of the stuff that Lola FX did with the anti-aging makeup, the age reduction stuff, which looked
Yeah, we've had an amazing response to that at fxguide.com. We actually got dug by the dig site, DIGG.com, and the hits went through the roof. But I think that was because we had some very high resolution files there. So there are actually 12-bit 2K frames of the original source material as well as the final stuff that Lola did. And you can really examine that if you're a VFX professional and see exactly what they've done.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating stuff. I took a look at a couple of the. I was one of the contributors to the bandwidth usage on your site. Take a look at a couple of those images, and it's really good to see the before and after. It helps you understand what they did and how much work they did to change the age of those characters. So.
Yeah, somebody commented that it wouldn't be bad Photoshop work if it was just done on a still, but doing that on moving footage, when you understand they had no consideration to it when they were shooting, there were no tracking markers, there wasn't even special effects makeup to make their hair darker. It was just 100% done in Inferno, actually.
Yeah, which seemed a bit odd to me that, why didn't they at least put a little hair dye in there or something instead of trying to do everything digitally? But who knows? So this week we're going to try something a little bit different since there wasn't any particular large, big budget visual effects film that came out last week. What we wanted to do, well, first of all, I should say that the absence of our other compatriot, Alex Lindsay. We had these grand plans where Alex, who is in Africa right now in Zimbabwe, would get on a hookup with everybody else hooked up down to Australia, and John was actually in India up until a couple of days ago. We would have had this incredible globe-spanning podcast that unfortunately didn't happen. When I last talked to Alex, we tried to get him hooked up and he had some kind of a power outage there. And in the meantime, John has returned from India. So we're still somewhat globe trotting, but not quite as extensively. But Alex will be back
But Alex,
next week, I assume.
Alex sends his best wishes from Africa.
Yes. So we'll try to, and actually I'm off to London in a couple of days, so maybe we'll be somewhat globe spanning even on that next one. But in the meantime, what we wanted to do was take a look at take a little of a look backwards instead of talking about movies that have come out very recently, and just real quick kind of go over a few of our favorites for DVDs, and in particular some of the special material that you find on the end of these DVDs, which are really an incredible resource for anybody that's trying to figure out what is done on some of these visual effects stuff. And when I think probably all three of us on this call here first got into this business, we didn't have a whole lot of resources where we could go see what had been done. There's the magazine Cinefex, which is great, but of course it's just stills. And I don't know about you guys, but there seems like there's an incredible amount of stuff that you can pick up from the DVDs now about how things were really put together. So I don't know, John. I know you said that you don't watch them a whole lot, but you were actually involved in a few of them during your tenure down at Weta and Lord of the Rings
Yeah,
time.
I am a little dubious about them, but that's probably because I guess because I'm involved in visual effects. You're right. They are a potentially tremendous resource, of information for people that are interested in visual effects. And so I guess if the audience is let's say younger people that are interested in understanding, how things are done,
I suppose I could see that being an interesting market, but I find them almost painful to watch. And that's not just because of the whole, you know, people who make sausage shouldn't watch it being made kind of thing. I just understanding, since I have, you know, since I have an understanding of you know, how visual effects are put together in general, if not specifically on for certain kind of work, I get bored very easily by them.
Well, and I think that's actually kind of reflected in a couple of them that I wanted to talk about too, which are not sort of traditional, here's your standard blue screen kind of breakdown sort of thing, because that is, you know, for me, that's the stuff that's I'm fairly familiar with too. So as we get into a couple of them, I talk about it, you'll see I kind of pick things that were a little bit off the beaten path, I guess.
I guess one of the things that that happens is you tend to focus in on the stuff that isn't your department. I know that I've got a pretty decent DVD collection, I'm sure you guys have, and I found that some of the best extras, of course, cover parts of the post-production process that maybe I myself am not necessarily doing. And when I'm watching the visual effects stuff, the stuff that we obviously know intimately well, it's almost the case that I'd watch it with the sound down. I mean, I don't, but I'm less concerned about what they're saying than just actually seeing the previews, seeing the raw footage. And I mean, obviously the explanations that go over the top are sometimes a bit simple for us. But by contrast, I loved hearing some of the plot points and some of the stuff that the writers come up with, and some of that stuff can be fascinating.
And it's true that those things all are kind of why we're in the business too, is not just to do the effects stuff. I think we're all sort of in this because we enjoy movies in general, and sort of understanding how the effects relate to the other disciplines is definitely a part of the fun.
Well, it's funny, actually, when I was in the gig at Weta, part of my responsibilities was to give tours to, you know, the occasional luminary that would wander through to have a look around at all the stuff that was going on with Lord of the Rings. And I recall quite often I would have to take them both through the digital side, Weta Digital, and also the physical workshop side, Richard Taylor's Weta workshop, where they were doing all the, you know, practical work, miniatures and armor and prosthetics, et cetera. And while we were doing the digital stuff, I almost felt like I was kind of, you know, a parrot, just going blah 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 blah. We used to call it the dog and pony show, and I'd point at screens and I go, and here's yet another model that we've been working on for 6 months. And then when I got to the workshop side, and as you say, Mike, the part that I don't do on a daily basis, I was always like, look at this stuff they're doing here. It's amazing. It's extraordinary. Look at these swords. You know, they hammer them out on forges by hand, et cetera, et cetera. So I suppose there is some of that going on. And it kind of.
But I think overall the physical stuff just is cooler, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think also the other fascinating thing, and obviously as a supervisor you get to face this, is when you're looking at a script, working out whether you're going to do it digitally or physically. And so seeing how other people have solved things physically is actually pretty interesting. I'll give you two examples. The first one is actually off Lord of the Rings, because I thought that the extras you guys did were just amazing. And the forced perspective stuff on the making of, I mean, I looked at the shots and I thought, well, I could do those digitally. It just didn't occur to me when I was in the cinema the first time round that they were all done with forced perspective. And then seeing how those motorized rigs worked and the tests that went into that were just fascinating. I mean, that's like gold to me, watching that stuff.
Yeah, you know, and the Lord of the Rings DVDs really are probably about as good as it gets for making of material, and especially in-depth look at some of the visual effects stuff. I know, John, you were interviewed on a couple of them, even involved with some.
Yeah,
of them.
I'm actually still angry over the second one. The truth is that the reason I think that the LOTR ones are so great is that Peter Jackson is such a fan himself of, you know, the medium, and you know, when I first met him in 1996, he was already a, you know, pretty heavy collector of laser discs at the time, and so was well into additional material for those films already. And so he was right on board very early on when New Line came in and said, you know, we'd like to have lots and lots and lots of extended material for these things. As a matter of fact, Peter Jackson with the Frighteners released on the Frighteners Laserdisc, I think there's four or five discs, 10 hours of material. It's just well over the top for a film that really wasn't that successful.
Yeah, I think they really recognize the value, though, of adding this kind of extra content from movies like that, where they will sell so many of these DVDs, where I think a lot of these, a lot of the times the DVDs now make as much money as the theatrical release or even more, perhaps. Sure. Right. Yeah. So Mike is.
Yeah, I think there are.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think there are stages as well, because the other thing is that obviously these are made for a fairly wide audience. And so what I tend to find is that I sort of categorize my DVDs extras for particular things. So, for example, if I wanted to show Force Perspective, you can't beat Lord of the Rings 1 as a disc if you're in a, you know, a planning meeting with someone and you wanted to, like, explain the concept. But, I mean, on the Fight Club DVD, they have an excellent thing on photogrammetry, and it really explains it, you know. On Clear and Present Danger, they have a great thing on previs. You know, I mean, it's like individual discs may not cover everything, but you'll find that, you know, a particular technique or a particular aspect of production is covered well on a disc, and then you can just maybe sometimes grab that when you're trying to explain it to somebody else.
Yeah, well, since you mentioned Fight Club, that's actually one of the ones that I had picked as something I wanted to talk about, so, and maybe perhaps you did too, so... but yeah, I think it's a great one, and it's also one that, like I said, I find it a lot more interesting than some of the run-of-the-mill ones, just because, I mean, part of, you know, the movie itself is a bit out there, not your average sort of film in a lot of different aspects, but I think the effects in there were also rather groundbreaking, you know, things that you just wouldn't normally do in an effects movie. There's this whole sequence where he's kind of talking about his very boring pedestrian life, where he buys a bunch of catalog furniture from, you know, a place called Fernie, which is a thinly veiled IKEA, and he's walking through his apartment, and all the different, you know, sort of Scandinavian furniture starts to fade in, and the catalog labels are floating around it and everything, and you get a good look at sort of how that's put together, and you can kind of watch the stuff fade on and everything, and, you know, that kind of stuff is side by side in the making of stuff with some of the more traditional stuff, like just a CG animal in the ice cave and that sort of thing. But the photogrammetry that you mentioned, which is, for those that aren't familiar with the term, it's a way of sort of taking photographs as textures, as opposed to painting up specific texture maps, and actually just taking a photograph of an object and getting all of the detail in there and then remapping that onto geometry. And it was used in a couple different places. Most of that sort of work was done by an effects company called Boof in Paris. And it's really good looking stuff, and in situations where you wouldn't think you would even be using effects, like pulling out of a trash can full of just very generic looking trash. Mike, had you looked through that DVD recently as well?
Yeah, no, I thought it was excellent. I mean, as I said, I've got it down as kind of, because I do this, I kind of tag things that I know I'm going to come back to. Because, you know, the problem often is, and I've done a lot of commercials work, and in commercials, you're often at a meeting and you'll say photogrammetry and everyone's eyes glass over. If you whip out a DVD and sort of show it, they go, that's good, no, we can do that. So there's a lot of referencing of stuff. Obviously, when I'm doing long form work, it's, you know, you have more time to produce tests, and you sort of say, we're going to use this technique, and then you just sort of show them an actual test you've done for it. But in short form work, you know, you really don't have that luxury. And I think that that's an excellent one. One of the ones I wanted to highlight, just in terms of why we got into the business, is just a brilliant piece on storytelling in the Godfather box set. Francis Ford Coppola, basically on the extra fourth disc of the trilogy box set, not only discusses how he broke down the script, but he actually shows how he cut up the book physically and pasted it into kind of picture frame pieces of paper so he could put annotated notes around the edges of the original book and have more of a margin than the book provided. And he's just sitting there, and this is like a loving explanation of a man who just, you know, really understood the filmmaking process. And having someone sit down and explain that, and it's quite a lengthy piece, it goes for like 20 minutes. It's a joy. It's got nothing to do with visual effects, but once you start getting into some of the storytelling aspects and how that crosses over to visual effects, then the extras become really, really valuable. And another example is the X-Men 2, because I know you guys did X-Men last week, and if you guys saw the X-Men 2 extras disc, but they were discussing the effect that Nightcrawler has when the it's the Banff effect, where he sort of jumps in the president's office.
The teleportation effect, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a nice effect. I remember watching it at the time. What I thought was really interesting is hearing the visual effects supervisor speak about that. He explained it in terms of the logic. They had to have the guy jump from scene to scene. How was it going to look? And it occurred to him that if somebody left a space, that air would rush in to fill that space, a bit like a thunderbolt. And so he started thinking about it in terms of the air suddenly coming in really fast. That would hit, then it would expand again. That led to the fluid dynamics and the smoke. And then obviously there's the character and the after effects. So that got to colored smoke and blue smoke. And then it went right from there to the art department tests, stuff they did in Photoshop, the previs, shooting it on set, and also CineSight with the fluid dynamics of how to actually realize that effect. And I thought that was really interesting because, you know, that kind of problem solving where you've got, okay, here is the logic or the thinking behind it that drives the visual effects, rather than just coming at it from a, wow, isn't this cool kind of point of view, can be really, you know, that's one of the, I think, the insights you do get from the extras.
I think that's exactly the really great thing about it is it's not just, you know, you can read as many books as you want about how to do visual effects or something like that, but all the little things that you would never really be able to put into a book or wouldn't even occur to you to put into a book about all the side stuff that goes on, the decision-making process, the strange coincidences that happen or fortunate coincidences sometime and unfortunate one at other time, and also just, you know, incredible things that can go wrong as you're moving along. You get a taste of that, which you wouldn't otherwise get. I don't know, John, I mean, how conscious of the DVD making of stuff were they when they were actually shooting Lord of the Rings, for instance? Was there a crew around the whole time?
Yeah, there was actually. New Line, you know, actually paid for a fairly established production company to come in and do it. It was led by a producer named Michael Pellerin, and they were pretty much there from day one. And as you'd imagine, that's fairly important. Usually, when you're kind of head down trying to get the visual effects work done, you don't have a lot of time to do the sort of, you know, note-taking and working on story through lines that make this kind of material so effective. So having a team whose sole task it is to produce this material is a big help. And you know, I'd say kudos to LOTR, you know, the sort of superstructure over at New Line, and Peter for making that happen. And it sort of led to the what might be called like a sort of the current pinnacle of this work in terms of just in terms of marketing, if not necessarily content, which is that Kong DVD that was, I believe, released in advance of the film. Like they were doing production diaries online and they had a
making of or something that was, yeah, that's
it was
right.
The same producer. Same producer came in and they were doing online production diaries and they released a lot of that material in advance of the film.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that.
That's actually a really interesting point because the website stuff. Yeah, they released the DVD of what was going on the web, which was obviously the production diaries. And then on the main Kong disc, they have the post-production diaries, which, by the way, has an excellent section on luster and color grading, which is an unusual bit to have on an extras. But I was going to flag that one because I think that's a really interesting point about these DVD extras, which is this stuff used to only be available as extras on DVDs. But, of course, now with the web, a lot of those extras were previously available for free on the internet. And that brings up an interesting point because, you know, you've got same thing with Superman, with the video production diaries, and with Star Wars video production diaries that are released on the net before the DVDs or the film are out.
It makes you wonder how far ahead of time they're going to start going with this. At some point, are we going to see web diaries of, you know, movies that are completely in pre-production even, and, you know, I could easily see something where they start putting up concept artwork just to judge the fans' reaction. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not, because you've already got movies that are somewhat made by committee, and conceivably it goes so far that, you know, every single step from script writing on downward ends up being sort of vetted on the web ahead of time. I'm not quite sure where the trade-off is there.
Well, I think we're due to see the results of that fairly soon, aren't we? Isn't that sort of describes snakes on a plane.
Well, very much so from a marketing point of view, yeah. Yeah, you've been hearing about that one
for quite
a while.
We're doing that on FX Guide. We're actually doing a from pre-production to post-production on a Stan Winston production called Deaths of Ian. And starting next week, we'll be basically covering the entire film. Whereas we'd normally cover it around release time, we'll be covering it from concept art before they even go off to the shoot.
Oh, that's great. So they haven't even started shooting stuff yet, and you're going to be putting it up there.
I tell you one thing that's really, really good related to this, and I don't know even if it's going to end up, and I'm slightly off topic here, but do you guys ever watch Battlestar Galactica, the program on the Sci-Fi Channel in America?
No.
Well, go ahead. They're putting out weekly podcasts, which are the commentary tracks that you would traditionally get on a DVD, so that each week when you're watching the show live to air on your television or on your TiVo, you can actually be listening to the commentaries at the same time. So that's an interesting extension of the idea of commentaries, to actually have them as, you know, you don't even have to buy a disc. You get them to listen to with the show, and they have a beat when it gets to the commercial breaks. And in addition to that, they just output 3 one-hour specials on the podcast, which were the writers' meetings. So the writers actually were just recorded doing normal discussions about the evolution of the series for that, you know, series two. And they discussed all the ways they could take the characters, and it was just a completely fly-on-the-wall recording. They weren't talking to it for the podcast. The podcast was just live recording. And so they're actively discussing, you know, should we kill this character? What will happen to this character? And having seen the series, of course, because they didn't release this until after the series was over, it was fascinating to see how they wove the visual effects in, where they were saving money on visual effects because they needed bigger stuff here and there. And that was all, of course, with just a TV show.
Yeah, it's it seems like, especially with some of these shows that have a really rabid kind of a fan base, there's so much potential for bringing the fans in even further, kind of sucking them in. And it's nice, at least at this point, that it's all fairly not designed to sell them stuff so much as to just get them interested in the show. But that, I think that may turn the corner at some point too.
You know, I have to say that I watch Battlestar Galactica. It's always felt a little bit like a guilty pleasure for me that I'm watching that stuff. If I was to strap on a podcast at the same time, I don't think my wife would speak to me.
Yes, I'm sure we all have very long-suffering wives. Mine is particularly patient with me.
Well, do you guys have like real high points, like top three, that sort of thing?
You know,
I have top.
Go ahead.
I have the absolute number one for the funniest friggin' extra on a DVD ever, in my opinion. And that's Star Wars Episode II with a pseudo-documentary called Beneath the Dome. Did you guys see that?
No, I haven't seen that one.
This is a guy called Spencer Sousa was here at Fox Studios. He's an editor. And he came up with the idea, and it just grew and grew and grew. And when you watch this, and actually we can put a link on the webpage, because it's actually now, it was put out on the web, it ended up on the DVD, and it's back on the web again. And so what he's done is he's done a behind-the-scenes on R2-D2, as if R2-D2 was a real actor who started in improv theater in San Francisco and was discovered. And the thing about it that just is, apart from the fact it's incredibly well done and really well written, is the people that they got to contribute. This thing took on a life of its own. They have, I'm not exaggerating now, Francis Ford Coppola discussing whether he could get him into The Godfather, Steven Spielberg discussing how he'd made him a beach ornament or a beach barrier in Saving Private Ryan, but hadn't really worked very well because R2-D2 had attitude. And it goes on to Richard Dreyfuss, who has some undisclosed huge artistic fight with R2-D2. And refuses to talk about him and generally like pans him as being a dickhead. And it has R2-D2 doing his own stunts and getting damaged. I mean, it's just unbelievably funny.
That sounds worth checking out, definitely. Well, I know that on an animated movie I worked on not too long ago called Valiant, which was done over in the UK, you know, once we finished the movie and it had been sent off and was getting ready for theatrical release, then immediately they got started working on the outtakes, as it were, which, of course, is something that Pixar started with, I guess, several movies back. And it's a ridiculous concept, since there are no real outtakes with flubbed lines and everything with the CG characters. But it's this little extra bit of something that you're starting to see put in a variety of different areas. And I know one thing, or at least something that they were playing with doing, and I don't know if they did or not, was not just these sort of mock outtakes as if somebody had flubbed their lines, but also showing some of the really strange rendering tests that had happened along the lines. And I've seen some great stuff at different facilities, and I haven't seen a whole lot of it make it onto DVDs, but weird things where you're trying to get fur on a creature and it looks like anything but fur. It's just like terrible mats of uncombed hair or whatnot.
I can't remember if I saw it on the DVD, but in one of the early massive tests for Lord of the Rings, because the agents have obviously a set of rules, and they were placed on a giant sphere, effectively, of to do this test, they had all the agents rushing at one side, at the red team effectively running at the blue team coming the other way. And there's one guy in the red team who just turns around and runs a completely opposite direction because his rules obviously had some bug in it that said it would work better if he went in completely the opposite direction, some kind of divide by zero. But it's the funniest thing to watch all these CG characters storming each other, screaming with swords blazing, and one guy
he was the smart one
off to the left.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, in terms of filmmaking, to answer your question more seriously, on the Star Wars Episode 3 disc, there's a thing called Under a Minute, and they took 49 seconds of the film, which is a fight with the lava. And this is a film that had like 2,100 effect shots. And they said, okay, how many people worked on this 49 seconds of film? And it was over 900 artists. And they go from costuming to on set with the stunt guys, one of which is actually a friend of mine. They went through matte painting, CG, you know, like right the way through until the film was done. And the documentary probably goes for another half an hour. But it's really fascinating to see all the different people that contribute to a shot. And, of course, the visual effects were very prominent in that. But so many other departments contributed so considerably as well. I mean, audio, for example.
Yeah, it really is a huge cooperative effort.
I guess I was going to say that I guess I'm I finally have a reason to rent all the Star Wars films. I have to confess I haven't actually seen them on DVD, so maybe I'll just pick them up and watch all the additional material.
I want to watch all six of them
right
at once. It's good. The one other disc that I wanted to call out to get a little bit more old school is John Carpenter's The Thing, which is, I'm not even sure when that was released, many, many years ago, because I was pretty young when I saw it, and but I think it's still just such a great movie. So I sat down, and of course I got sucked into watching the movie, but I watched the bonus materials on that as well. And it's great because it's, you know, I think on a lot of these older movies where everything was done with traditional visual effects and optical effects and that kind of thing, there's not as much material still available. Nowadays, of course, you know, like we've been talking about, there's crews on set capturing all of this, and everything being digital means it's there and it's available. But going back to some of these older movies pre-digital, there's not nearly as much material, but fortunately The Thing has quite a bit of good stuff in there. And they had a mixture of you know, blue screen work and a lot of miniature work, some of which was eventually some stop motion animation, which was eventually cut from the movie just because it didn't quite work as well. And then a lot of the practical effects and stuff with Rob Bottin, who's one of the sort of the gods of makeup effects and animatronic kind of stuff, talking through a number of different shots and especially talking about all the things that would go wrong with setting up for an entire day and then trying to get the shot, you know, and in the matter of a few seconds, everything goes wrong and they realize they have to do it all over again. And it's really fascinating to watch that stuff and see how good some of the stuff works and how bad some of the other stuff looks too, especially stuff that was sort of in progress. But the other really interesting thing on there is there's a fair number of matte paintings in The Thing, but there's this whole little mini section where Al Whitlock, who's one of the great old-time matte painters, there's this whole little mini piece, a little featurette as part of discussing matte paintings in The Thing that actually goes through a bunch of additional matte paintings that Al Whitlock did for, you know, going back to Hitchcock movies like The Birds and some other things like that. So that's worth checking out just in and of itself to see the old traditional, you know, painted on glass kind of matte paintings being used to do visual effects, you know, the way God intended.
Yeah, Whitlock's work was amazing. His stuff on Hindenburg was just astounding.
Yeah, and then they showed a couple of clips from Hindenburg as well on the bonus features for The Thing.
I'll give you a couple of funny examples because, again, I think the trouble is with these DVDs, you have to watch a lot of them to get anything of any value. But if you do have them on when you're doing something else, and you can keep an ear out, then there are real little gems. I find the little gems, especially the practical ones, really happen in the Bond films. There was like a, you know, the classic thing where they throw out the tacks and the car tire goes down and then reinflates mm-hmm. itself. And they did this in one whole shot. And I was looking at it and I was thinking to myself just quietly, I wonder how I do that. And they just, you know, said in the extras that it was as simple as having the car actually on the back of a lifter. And what simply happened is there was a, you know, a thing that you use for raising and lowering cars when they're getting their tires changed. And the wheel was always deflated. It was always empty of air. It was just lifted up, thus having no pressure on it, looking like it was inflated. As soon as it went over the tacks, they just lowered it down. And then as soon as it was meant to be reinflated by Bond, they just cranked it back up again. And of course, a close-up shot on the wheel, it just seems to be full of air, goes down, comes back up again. And I'm thinking, you know, if you're a filmmaker these days and you didn't have much budget, being able to pull off stuff like that would just be, would make such a difference.
And, you know, as today, opposed to like, I'd be willing to bet if you went to a visual effects facility and said, you know, bid this shot out for us, you're looking at tens of thousands of dollars to do that same thing.
Yeah, and you're so right. I mean, it's, you know, it's, if you can get it in set, you know, kind of why not? And another one that was really interesting on that X-Men one we mentioned before, they had this 25-foot high dam section. I don't know if you guys have shot water, and I'm sure you have, and how hard it is to scale. And, you know, you're always after microwaves and stuff. And when I say microwaves, I mean small, micro, yeah, little bit of detail.
We talked a little bit about that with the podcast we did on Poseidon a few weeks back.
Exactly, yeah, that's right. Well, anyway, they had this section of 25 foot, and it was meant to be, well, you know, how big's the dam? It was a fictitious dam, so it was like they said that it was somewhere between quarter and sixth scale, which of course meant that the thing would only be 100 foot high, and that wasn't nearly big enough. And I, again, it was like, you know, how do you solve the problem? And thinking sort of outside the box, they didn't try and make this dam section look like it was the whole dam. They just stuck high pressure hoses behind it, filmed it, and then matted that in as it one small section of the dam that blew. And consequently, their whole dam was just a very small part of the dam, and hence the water scaled really, really well. And I think that on set, you just have to be aware of that kind of stuff. Things come up and people look at stuff and go, well, that doesn't look very good. And if you can come back with stuff quickly and ways around things, then I think that can really make a big difference.
Yeah, and I think that's also why some of the guys that have started off doing traditional stuff, even though digital has sort of rolled through the process, you know, the good guys are still out there working, and digital is just one more tool, but they're able to kind of pick which one makes the most sense out of their bag of tools.
Yeah, though mind you, do you guys see the Apollo 13 making of? When they actually took the guys into, I mean, I was like, how do they do the weightlessness? Well, they actually got them weightless by using the vomit comet.
Yep.
That was like a real cheat. It's like, well, you know, what chance does that give me? Unless NASA's willing to work with you, what chance do you have?
But, you know, we did a weightless shot, and I worked on the Robert Zemeckis film Contact many years ago, and there was some weightless stuff, and all we ended up doing for that was just flipping the entire set, having the entire set upside down, and the actors sort of being suspended, but because everything was sort of flipped, it gave it a strange enough feel, like everything was floating, and whenever you release something, you know, the clothing and everything like that moved in the opposite direction you would expect it to, and so it didn't feel like there was gravity, it felt like everything was sort of bubbling up. And the only thing that gives it away, if you watch real close, is one of the actors is being held, sort of hung completely upside down, and you can see that the vein on his forehead kind of popping out from all the blood rushing to his head. But other than that, it seemed to work pretty seamlessly.
Apparently on 2001, one of the few mistakes, and that was just a magnificent piece of filmmaking, was that when one of the guys is sucking on something in a straw, he lets go, and of course the fluid goes back down inside the straw. Apart from that, the weightlessness was perfect. But I was like, you know, hey... 2001. Oh my God,
they're allowed. That's good. Any other particular discs that jump out at people?
I was going to say, I think if somebody really wants to learn about visual effects, we should also point out that a lot of this extra material does appear at conferences. Like, I know that I've seen a bunch of the stuff at conferences like VES, which is coming out. So I guess just to say that if people are really into the extra stuff, some of those conferences can be really worth attending, and they're probably, you know, my first preference for getting in-depth info as to how visual effects are done.
Yeah, the Visual Effects Society, the VES that you mentioned, is a society that has mostly meetings in the Los Angeles area, but there's a number of meetings in other large cities as well. I'm not sure how open the VES meetings are to the general public, but I know there's also the SIGGRAPH conference is coming up in about a month or so. That's the special interest group on computer graphics that runs around the various locations each year. And this year it's in Boston. And I was just looking over the program for that, and there are a number of presentations on how visual effects were done for certain recent movies. So if anybody's in the Boston area in about a month.
We just had AEAF here where John Bruno spoke about X-Men 3. And interestingly, what made me think of that is that they use the same trick of filming upside down when Wolverine's trying to get through before Xavier's killed in the house scene. And it was the same trick, just shooting upside down.
I don't know if AAF is the same as SIGGRAPH, but SIGGRAPH turns out to be quite a bit of kind of a job fair as well. So people that are interested in getting into the industry, or people that are in the industry looking for new work, tend to sort of congregate there.
Yeah, it's a good one to check out for anybody that's wanting to get in or at least see what this industry is like. And it's not just visual effects for SIGGRAPH. It's very much sort of all the disciplines related to computer graphics, which is good because there's so many different areas that are putting this technology to use these days.
And then there's the web, of course. For those people that can't afford conferences and DVDs, there is just so much on the web, so it is pretty accessible these days.
Yep.
Well, like this, really.
Exactly. Very good. All right, guys. Well, I think we will wrap it up then. Thank everybody for joining in. John LaBrie here in Los Angeles, as myself, and Mike Seymour from Australia. And his website is www.fxguide.com. And I've got a little website up also. It's just digitalcompositing.com. I'm not quite sure what we've got scheduled for next week or so. We'll have to regroup once Alex is back in the country, and even though I'll be out of country, I'll be a little bit more accessible than Africa, and we will hopefully see everybody back here in a week or so. Thanks, everybody.
And Ron, I think it's worth mentioning the forums for the VFX show at macbreak.com, the link off there, because I know Alex has been very active in the forums, answering questions from people about the show.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you know, keep a dialogue going about all the stuff that we talked about here, and several of us will pop on there every now and then, and you can grill us about things we said, or call us liars about things we said, or just discuss it as well. So, very good. All right, then. Thanks, everybody, and
we'll
keep it real.
You.